Detsana, on the 10th of June, 1979. All the Buddhas attain enlightenment and attain to the true realization of the truth and Dhamma, which is found within this world. All of them attain to the same kind of penetration and realization, and their teaching was of the same nature. None of them were unethical, and they did not teach Dhamma in an aberrant and perverse manner, like the Buddhist followers of today. They are indecorous and ostentatious, trying to outdo the Lord Buddha. There are many of this kind, despite the fact that the way and the ideal are still extant. But they just don't want to follow it. This is because they simply want to be famous and distinguished. If one follows the principles of the sasana, then one will be free of errors, flawless and impeccable. Whether one is a bhikkhu or a lay person, one will be endowed with sila and dhamma. If one just practices following the principles of the sasana that one has faith in, then how can one ever get into trouble? The reason for division and breaking up into the various sects is the conduct that goes against the Dhamma and the Vinaya, crushing and trampling on the Dhamma and Vinaya, which are the truth, thus replacing the sasana of the Lord Buddha with the Gilesas by thinking that this is the proper and correct way of doing things. If they accord with one's preferences and obsessions, then they must be right. These ways then keep on growing. These are the grosser kind of kilesas. Concerning the more subtle ones that are found within the heart of every one of us, including those of us practitioners, who have been constantly fooled by their tricks. What are they? Hatred, anger, and aversion, and the obsessions of one's aramana that are created by one's thinking and concocting, which are influenced by the kilesas that arise within one's heart, with oneself being totally unaware of it. But we are totally engrossed and immersed in this enticement. They are all found within the heart of everyone. The Lord expounded that all of these things are harmful. Whatever is detrimental is productive of injury and damage. Love and hatred, anger and animosity, the heart's obsession for sights and sounds, smells, tastes and touches, and the Dhammaramana that are influenced and created by the kilesas, which cause us delusion and infatuation, are all harmful. The Dhamma has already pointed this out, but we tend to be enticed and hypnotized by them constantly. If we do not fall for them and are not captivated by them, how can the heart not find any calm? We have to be vigilant and take care of our thinking and concocting, curbing the confusion and chaos of the heart, which is just the disturbances of the kilesas, which take sanya and sankhara as the instrument, thus afflicting our heart with trouble and hardship. This is something that we haven't yet seen the harm of. When the citta has not attained to calm, then it is already obvious that it is being afflicted with harm. This damage is the state of confusion and restlessness which keeps the citta from coming to calm. The reason why the citta cannot gain calm is because of agitating and disturbing influences. There are things that oppose the citta. If the practitioner doesn't reflect on the harm in this way, then he will not be able to find anything worthwhile. The wonderful quality of the citta, which is the state of calm, will not be able to come forth. One has to constantly give thought to these things, and one has constantly to see them as harmful, and be very careful and cautious. If one is not vigilant, how can one expect to come across the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? If these things constantly obstruct the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana, how can one ever realize them when every time one thinks, one's thoughts always go in the way of the kilesas? Whatever one concocts, and whatever one turns one's mind to, it is never about the truth and Dhamma, but only about the kilesas, tanha and asava. How then can one ever come across the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? One has to apply one's mind as a practitioner. One must not avoid doing this contemplation. The kilesas are in perpetual activity. They go in the way of sankhara and sanya. They are constantly active, going in the way of sanya. With the sight and sound, they only go through occasionally when the external and internal ayatana come into contact. This happens intermittently from time to time. But the Dhamma Ramana that arise from the contact with the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, and which disturb and agitate oneself, are things that one ceaselessly thinks about and constantly concocts up. Whatever one concocts up, this is the work of the kilesas, not the work of Dhamma, and not the work of sati and panya. But when it is the work of panya that concocts up and contemplates these things, then it is the work of Dhamma. When sankhara entertains the thoughts of truth and Dhamma, analyzing and differentiating the element aggregates, reflecting and contemplating with wisdom, then it will go in the way of Dhamma. When it concocts up the affairs of Dhamma, then it goes in the way of Dhamma. The perception of sanya must be following the work of investigation. It is like following a line that has already been drawn out. This is the way that sanya has to follow, and then it will be in accordance with Dhamma. As it is, 95% of the time, it is the work of the kilesas, and even the remaining 5% hardly ever goes in the way of truth and Dhamma, in all the various postures. Thus, in the practice of Dhamma, one can hardly ever come across and clearly perceive the Dhamma within one's heart, such as the state of calm. This calmness is not far away, for as soon as one is capable of curbing and restraining this aramana with sati, then the state of calm will appear. Nevertheless, we are still not capable of calming our hearts and freeing them from these disturbing and agitating influences. How, then, are we going to come up with the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? I have expounded this to you countless times, more frequently than the kilesas, have swarmed over your heart. By now you should be able to bear it in mind and take it up for contemplation and investigation. The work of overcoming and uprooting the kilesas is a Herculean task. There is nothing more tenacious than the kilesas, and I myself have already experienced this. I really had to put all of my life into it. Looking back at the way I practiced, I cannot help but having apprehension at the way I struggle, for now I would not be able to put forth that kind of effort. That is how intense it was. My physical condition is no longer favorable for this kind of exertion, and neither do I have the determination. These days, I am just passing my days doing nothing, living a flat and zestless existence. There is no ambition, even for the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana. And this is not being contemptuous of them. I am speaking about the truth of the citta, as there is now a great contrast to before. All I had then was the intent and steadfast determination for the truth and Dhamma, and for the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana, the state of freedom. When one's aspirations are at this extreme, then everything is geared toward and concentrated at one's goal. The goal is then like a magnet that attracts every facet of one's exertion, endurance, and perseverance. One's diligent effort, endurance, perseverance, and one's tenacious and warlike quality will all come by themselves. This is because one's determination and aspiration for the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana is pulled to the brim within one's heart. Nothing can easily undermine this resolve. One can readily shake the kilesas loose, even though one hasn't yet developed one's sati and panya to a very high degree. But one's determination is very strong and powerful, regardless of how toilsome and arduous one's exertion is. One just keeps on persevering and keeps on fighting and struggling with the kilesas. They are extremely tenacious. One cannot do it lightly, taking it easy and letting the heart drift aimlessly. One must be firmly grounded with truth and reason. The conviction for Dhamma is a crucial basis of heart. Once one has the belief in Dhamma, then one has to follow the instruction of Dhamma. Dhamma says that we have to resist, so we must resist. For instance, when we want to see something, we have to resist this urge. And when we want to listen to the things that go in the wrong way and which promote the growth of the kilesas and are harmful and detrimental for us, then we must not listen to them. Whatever we crave for, we have to resist that craving. And this is not only about hearing and seeing. If there is any desire that goes in the way of the kilesas, then we must resist all of it. There is dukkha in resisting the kilesas. But let us face this dukkha. This resistance is for the overcoming, uprooting, and eradicating of those things that are embedded within the heart, and which have been afflicting the heart for such a long time. We are fighters, and we must resist. One who is going to uproot and resist the harms and poisons within the heart must be a fighter. He has to be tough and hardy, enduring and persevering. Once we have established the principal basis, then everything will be manageable. One will not be concerned with the four living requisites, which are food, shelter, clothing, and medicines, for one's interest now is all focused at the truth and Dhamma, focusing ultimately at the Magga, Pala and Nibbana, and the state of deliverance. This interest is extremely forceful, and so all the other things cannot disturb and bother the heart. One only lives for the cultivation that will lead one to freedom. When one eats, one only eats so that one can cultivate for the state of deliverance. And when one goes to sleep, it is only for the purpose of resting and re-strengthening the body, so that one can put up the exertion for the state of freedom right within one's heart. Everything that one does is solely for this purpose. When one's determination is so highly intense, then one will naturally become very tough and strong. Have the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana really faded away? Where are these Magga, Pala, and Nibbana? They are found right within the heart. They are being concealed and covered up by the kilesas, and the heart has become worthless as there is no virtue or value within it. This is because the kilesas have wiped them all out. Can we yet see the harm of the kilesas? They have wiped out all the goodness and all the supreme and marvelous things within our hearts. All the things that are appearing at the front are just the work of the kilesas. We are merely substituting the real and genuine things for the fake and counterfeit things. Aren't we ever disgusted with them? We have to look up to the teachers who are famous and are revered by the people, the bhikkhus and the samaneras. We have to look at the way they practiced. I have already talked to Than Ajahn Khao, and he was terribly intense and resolute in his exertion. Because this resolution can be carried to the extreme, with oneself not being aware of it, it can become fanatical. One can discipline oneself to the extent where this work of this disciplining is antagonistic to oneself. This is due to one's strength and tenacity. In the application of one's mind, one must therefore be many-sided, strategic, and versatile. This is what he related to me. He was really rigorous and resolute. He also talked about the time that he was staying with his teacher in Chiang Mai, and also in the various places that he put forth his exertion. It was an uphill struggle for him. His striving was rendered difficult due to his age when he ordained as a bhikkhu. He was already quite old and already had a family. His teacher also tried very hard in being aloof, in solitude and seclusion, alone by himself. He just wouldn't allow anybody to come close to him. He was Than Ajahn Mun. When Than Ajahn Mun went to live in Chiang Mai, he tried to follow him, and eventually ran into him and sought for permission to stay with him and listen to Than Ajahn Mun expounding the truth and Dhamma to him. In his strenuous exertion, he put his whole life into it. I have also talked with Than Ajahn Brom, and it was very satisfactory. He had already transcended and achieved the ultimate when he was living in Chiang Mai. All of these teachers were really resolute and determined. The chance of coming across the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana is very slim if one just lives casually. Than Ajahn Khamdi was also very, very adamant and strong-willed, but his personality has now completely turned around. He said that before, he was very stubborn and unyielding, but it was due to the strength and resolve of the citta. But he has now changed. That was what he said. One who is going to combat and conquer the kilesas must always be strong and forceful, and always opposing and resisting. One must not see anything better than Dhamma appearing within the citta. Then the citta will be noble due to the Dhamma that one has cultivated. The citta can become awful and terrible due to the kilesas that cover it up. It becomes totally worthless due to the kilesas. There are very many of these kilesas that obscure and cover up, so that one is not able to come across the truth. One just cannot see them. All they are just fiery things, the fires of the kilesas, tanha and raka. Are fires that are constantly consuming the heart. It is hot when one is standing, sitting, or lying down. In all postures, one is always afflicted with this heat. One is totally overwhelmed with this annoyance, and one looks at everything in the wrong light. This is because the heart is in the wrong. It is being poisoned and is injurious to itself. One cannot have peace and coolness when one looks at one's fellow in Dhamma. One is vexed and edgy, finding faults with others as a means of venting the kilesas that are consuming one within. This can actually happen, no matter how transcendent one's teacher might be. One is not capable of perceiving this because the kilesas themselves are not marvelous things. So when they have totally enveloped the citta, how then can the citta think about those wonderful and supreme things? It can only go according to the design of the kilesas. One must therefore discipline and train oneself. And one really must achieve this. At least, one should be able to attain to calm, so that one can clearly see the result of one's practice. And this is the sitting in samadhi bhavana. This will at least bring forth samadhi, the state of calm of the heart. This cannot be beyond the training and disciplining of one's heart. We have been neglecting the citta. In looking for profit for oneself, one has to be calculating. One has to make an assessment of the value of the flow of the citta that has been constantly thinking for such a long time. What has one come up from this thinking? We have been constantly following it and have been captivated by it. The more we oblige these thoughts, the more fuel we put on the fire, which is productive of our trouble and hardship. Are we still going to persist in cooperating with these things, to become enchanted and mesmerized by them, although we are wide awake? We have to ponder upon this. This is called Dhamma, the means of coping with the kilesas. If one doesn't devise up sati and panya, then there will not be a way of overcoming the kilesas. One will only be groping and doing guesswork. When one sits in practice, one only sits as a mere token. And when one experiences minor pain and difficulties, while the citta hasn't yet attained to calm, one simply gives up and goes to sleep. And when one takes a break to go to sleep, to relieve all of this dukkha, then this is merely a way of promoting the kilesas. The more strength one gains from this sleeping, then the more the kilesas and raga tanha will be enhanced. We have to make comparisons. We have to make assessments so that we can see things clearly. Then there will be a way for us to struggle with them. Why can't we dig and search and come up with the truth and Dhamma so that we can use it as our testimony, as a thing to compete and wrestle with the kilesas? When we have the propensity for reason and for Dhamma, for the sake of being free from dukkha, surely we can achieve this one of these days. It will happen inevitably to one who likes to contemplate and reason things out for the purpose of uprooting himself. By using those logical arguments, that he can come up with. People do not become brilliant from the first day of their birth. We all carry ignorance with us, as we are all born in the midst of the kilesas, which are the cause of all living beings' stupidity. To become wise, we have to depend on Dhamma, the truth and the teacher, and the work of disciplining and training oneself. One's behavior and bearing will steadily rise above average, as the heart becomes steadily developed due to the work of cultivation. For this reason, the work of development, learning, and hearing are extremely crucial. One can be really captivated and enchanted by listening to the Dhamma of a teacher whose mode of practice and the results that came from it are certain and indisputable. For one who has truly attained to truth and insight, there is no speaking out of uncertainty and vagueness, such that doubts and uncertainty may arise in us. Whatever he talks about is always true and valid, because he has already truly experienced them. Both the causes that he has cultivated and the results that arise as a consequence of this. So when he talks about these things, how can he be wrong or contradicted? Like the Lord Buddha, who expounded and proclaimed the Dhamma to the world. The number of the Dhammas that can be accounted for is 84,000, which is very small indeed. It is not very many at all, as I see it. I can really accept what Than Ajahn Mun said about this matter. He said that the Dhamma found within the scriptures is comparable to the water filling a jar. The 84,000 Dhammas are comparable to the water inside a jar. It is hardly a great number. But the Dhamma not found within the texts is similar to the water in the ocean. How wide and how deep is this? And how great is the difference between them? This is because he practiced every day of his life. He was experiencing and perceiving these things every day. The citta was really impressed and was able to understand many aspects of Dhamma. The depth and profundity of this Dhamma is immeasurable, for his citta was no longer involved or entangled with anything. It was the citta of one who had already attained to deliverance. He said that it was a great pleasure and very gratifying to do investigations into these Dhammas. If the citta is compared to a large fish in the ocean, then it has plenty of room to maneuver, as the ocean is very large and extensive, and the fish is enormous. For the heart that has attained to ultimate purity, how can its investigation into the Dhamma be limited to a certain level of profundity and subtlety? There is no bound and limit for this heart. It can smoothly and easily set sail, for there are no longer kilesas to entangle and shackle the heart. When it is tied up with the kilesas, then it is not possible for it to roam about freely, as it is constantly being surrounded by them. It is totally restrained and prevented by the kilesas from going anywhere. The kilesas are just all over it. One lives with the kilesas, one sits with the kilesas, and when one thinks about the affairs of the kilesas. One's thoughts and concoctions all go in the way of the kilesas. Everything is entirely the work of the kilesas. So then the Dhamma cannot appear within the heart. But when the kilesas have been totally vanquished, and one attains to vimutti, then it will be the same way that Than Ajahn Mun described. Wherever one sits, the insight into the Dhamma will steadily arise ceaselessly. He was convinced that the knowledge and insight of the Lord Buddha and the Savakas who had attained to deliverance must have been immeasurable, extensive, and enormous. Their Dhamma is compared to the sky and the oceans. There are no bounds and limits, as their knowledge and insights are very wide and extensive, very deep and profound. He said this based on his own personal experience. He was fully impressed and had utter conviction in the insight and accomplishment and the brilliance and wisdom of the Lord Buddha and all of the Savakas. He said that he had no doubt in this at all. What I wrote down was just a brief sketch of the essence of what he said. But when one listened to how he expounded it, one became captivated by what he said. It was very impressive, pleasant, and sweet sounding, for it was the one who knows who spoke. And that is what Dhamma is like. When the citta cowers, it really cowers. And when it is gloomy, it is really gloomy. When it is being overshadowed by the kilesas, then it can become really gloomy. Once one has trained, disciplined, transformed and developed, correcting and overcoming and getting rid of the kilesas, the elegance and serenity of the citta will then steadily appear. The worth and benefits will be realized right within that citta. When the kilesas are steadily diminishing, then the value of the citta will steadily appear. Because the intrinsic nature of the citta is already worthwhile and valuable. The reason why the value of the citta is not apparent is due to those worthless things enveloping it. The citta then appears to become filthy and corrupted, having no worth and being something undesirable. Is dukkha desired by anybody? But how does it manage to overshadow the heart of the world? Dukkha arises from the kilesas, and nobody wants the kilesas, because they are only productive of dukkha. But we cannot help carrying the burden of dukkha and experiencing this dukkha, as these things are all within ourselves, for we are not yet capable of coping with them with our sati, panya, satta, and diligent effort of all facets. We therefore have to endure them. But in any case, we who are the fighters must not retreat. We have to be firm and strong, as this is very crucial for us. We have to train ourselves to be earnest. Don't be playful and vacillating, like a post that stands up in a pile of buffalo dung and constantly keeps falling down. Don't toy with your practice, for then you will never be able to come up with any substance. Whatever you do, you have to be true to it. Really commit yourselves, for you are the practitioners. If we are true and earnest in what we do, then all of these things will consolidate themselves and become powerful. When it is time for you to be serious with your exertion, to be serious in the work of overcoming and eliminating every kind of kilesa, then you will be real and earnest. When you are earnest with your external dealings, it is not only profitable for these external things, but it will also instill the disposition for the citta to be real and earnest with this inner development in the work of overcoming and correcting the kilesas. This is the vital principle. I have to talk to you about this out of my concern for you, though it is inconvenient for me. I still put in my effort to come and talk to you, as I have already seen the harm of the kilesas, and have seen how they trample and damage the heart. Sometimes they used to trample all over me, right in front of my eyes, as I didn't have the strength to resist them. But when I was able to master up some energy, I didn't attack them at full force. I really thrust at them. I was provoked with rage and vengeance. But as I was not able to cope with them with skill and strategy, I was then forced to endure them. But I was really enraged and boiling inside. However, when I had accumulated the strength of Sati and Panya, I then went on the offensive. When one is able to establish some Sati to fortify one's energy of heart, which has attained to calm, one has now set up resources and fortified one's energy and strength. Once the citta has attained to calm, then it is free from the confusion and chaos that the citta is involved with, as if it is insane. When all of this confusion and madness subsides, then one feels relaxed and at ease. This is samadhi, or the state of calm. Once the citta has attained to calm, then it will become restful and comfortable. Once the citta becomes satiated and does not crave for any aramana, due to its being full of dhamma, which is the state of calm, then if one wants to put it to work by investigating and contemplating with panya, it will always go in the way of panya. It is unlike the time when the citta is hankering and craving for things, and one is not able to come up with anything worthwhile when one does the investigation. It just keeps on messing around and turning into sanya aramana. Whatever one investigates will turn into sanya aramana. That is why the Lord said that panya that is being developed by samadhi is of great result and benefit. Samadhi acts as the support for panya. Once one has attained to calm and one investigates in the way of panya, then it will go in the way of panya. The level of panya will correspond to the level of samadhi. This will keep steadily progressing until panya becomes subtle, bright, and brilliant. The more one comes across one's results of practice, then the more one will become motivated. Once the time comes for one to become wise and courageous, then nothing can slip through one's attention. This is when one's strength has matured to the ultimate level. There will be no retreat. In the beginning stages, one is submissive and is trampled on by the kilesas. The kilesas keep on stamping on one's head, regardless of how infuriated and enraged one might be. One has to endure it, because one doesn't have any strength, sati or panya, to counter them. So during such time, one has to give in to them. This was when my citta hadn't yet established any foundation or basis. The kilesas then kept on trampling and damaging myself in all postures, standing, walking, sitting, and lying down. I could not find any peace and happiness. I went through enough of these experiences myself, and I am telling you about it in a straightforward way. It happened to me. Even while I was doing nothing, the pressure inside was so intense. I really wonder what the citta had been thinking about, for it was then burning hot within. This is like a fire burning rice husks, burning and smoldering deeply within. I wonder how it managed to get to be like this. I kept on observing, but it remained like that, as I didn't have any sati and panya. Therefore, it was useless. There was no sati and panya to unravel these things. And that is what it is like when there is no panya. I just had to persevere. However severe this blaze and dukkha was, I had to endure it. No matter how offended I was, I had to remain in that state. It was really of no use for me to become enraged, but I did not relent in putting in the effort until I came across the state of calm. Once I had attained to calm, I then prepared myself for the offensive. My exertion in the way of developing samadhi would become very intense. I got to the point where, in order to enter into samadhi, I did not have to go through the normal rituals of getting prepared for getting ready into that state. I could simply acquire it without having to do anything. This is the time when one has attained to the skill and expertise level of samadhi. As the citta is now always in a state of samadhi, all of the time. The samadhi that arises from sitting practice and is the state of calm that is totally devoid of any thinking process is one type of samadhi. Another type of samadhi, which we call samadhi bhavana, is the state in which the citta remains in calm, but one is still capable of doing some thinking, concocting, and contemplating. But the foundation of the citta is as firm as a rock. It is as stable as a rock. That is how firm the basis of samadhi has become. When one has entered into the state of calm repeatedly, then this is the way of developing the base of samadhi. This is the way of perpetual nurturing of it. After withdrawing from the restful state of samadhi, which one enters from time to time as a way of resting the khandhas, one can still see very clearly that the foundation of stability is still very firm and solid. One is now ready for the offensive drive. If one now wants to intensify one's effort in the development of panya, then it will not take one very long. But instead, one becomes attached to this state of samadhi. One is now so skillful that one can just enter the state of samadhi any time that one wants to. It doesn't even take a minute to do it. As soon as one establishes it, one goes right into it. And this is because one has already established the foundation of samadhi. So it is very easy and quick to restrain the activity of the citta, to enter into that base right away. This is when one is very skillful. Consequently, when one goes in the path of panya, one can progress very quickly. But one instead becomes attached to that state of samadhi by taking the knowingness that exists in a singular state as nibbana. This is how it can happen when one becomes attached to samadhi. So then one pays no attention to the investigation in the way of panya. It took Tanajanman to drive me out of that state. But once the citta had got out of that state, it then became very vigorous, as it was now ready and well equipped. With that kind of samadhi, how can it not be ready? The samadhi of that level is subtle enough. Once it goes in the way of panya, it then begins to turn relentlessly around. It begins to learn about the various aspects of things and becomes capable of cutting off the various kinds of kilesas. One now becomes amazed and marvels at the efficacy of Panya, for one now has seen the testimony to its value, which further enhances one's effort. All the laziness has totally disappeared. Please don't have the understanding that on the level of samadhi, one is not lazy, for one is, in not wanting to do the work of contemplation, thinking, and analysis. One just wants to rest in the state of stillness and comfort. This is the lazy kind of samadhi. Once it had been driven out by Tanajan Man to go into the work of investigation, and once it had investigated and learned the knack of doing investigation, then the diligent effort just came by itself. But for me, the citta tended to go to the extreme. Once it had gone into the path of Panya, it was not able to go into samadhi because it was no longer interested in doing so. The citta just kept turning around incessantly in the work of investigation and struggling with the kilesas. Sometimes this went on throughout the night, and one didn't get any sleep. And in the daytime, one still couldn't sleep. When I did the walking practice, I was not able to walk straight, for there was a tendency to keep crashing to the ground. This was due to the lack of sleep, because the citta was still keeping on doing the work of analysis and examination, coping with the kilesas, tanha, and asavas. As far as surrendering oneself to the kilesas was concerned, it is out of the question. One would rather lose one's life, and the only time that one is defeated is when one dies. This is the only way to be defeated. Giving in by retreating simply cannot happen. It is not possible. It can only happen if one's head is cut off. Defeat can only occur if one loses one's life. But to give up by retreating is just not possible. Once one has attained to this level, this will happen. I am just telling you the truth, and I am not trying to boast to you. I am speaking from the principle of truth concerning the causal aspect of practice, how I cultivated and how I exerted myself, and how I had to wage an uphill struggle. How lazy I was. I was carrying the burden of the kilesas, tanha and asava, and shouldering the burden of fire right within my heart, both day and night, standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. This fire had never been apart from the heart. I had already shouldered this burden. Once I had trained, disciplined, and developed the heart by earnestly exerting myself and enduring and persevering, then the heart was able to attain to the state of calm. Once one had gained calm, one became strengthened. Then one was able to drive harder. One can now intensify one's effort in the practice of bhavana. The calm of the citta will increase and become more profound until one thinks that it is nibbana. One now becomes heedless. Once the knowingness becomes densely concentrated, then there is no thinking or concocting. It is as if the world is not there. What remains is just the subtle and profound knowingness. In the end, one assumes that this state is what Nibbana will be like. Fortunately, I did not actually claim it as being Nibbana beforehand. I just assume that this is what Nibbana would be. I only construe that this will be Nibbana. So fortunately, I only claim that this will be. It was only after I had investigated with Panya that I was able to discern what this state was still involved with. So how then could it be Nibbana? For once Panya has analyzed and unraveled the citta that was still full of kilesas, then they began to appear and show themselves. The kilesas had merely been put to rest, merely been calmed down due to the power of samadhi overshadowing them. They were merely being restrained from acting. But as soon as they made their appearance, then they would be immediately cut down by Panya, as one is now on the path of Panya. Panya doesn't promote the growth of the kilesas. It only does the work of putting them out and destroying them. Panya will now steadily progress along. This is the way it is with the citta of this level. When one is afflicted with dejection, one can be really depressed. When one is living among one's fellows in Dhamma, one casts the blame upon oneself, thinking that all one's fellows in Dhamma appear to be totally rid of the kilesas, leaving oneself alone to be consumed by fire. This was the way I felt when I first went to stay with Thanajanman. When I look at all the other bhikkhus, they appear to be serene and peaceful, though their exertion didn't seem to be that intense. But I, on my part, after finishing the morning meal, would go into the forest and put in the practice until it was time to sweep in the afternoon. Then I would come back out. But I didn't achieve anything. That was because at that time, my citta had deteriorated, and I was trying to intensify my effort to bring back the citta to that higher level. My striving was very strenuous and intense, but after having some conversation on Dhamma with my fellows in Dhamma, then I began to learn about their story. And when I had established some basis, I also began to know about myself. I could see this clearly, as well as all of my peers. How could they not know? Because when I went to talk to my teacher, I had to tell him the truth so that he could advise and tell me how to correct the things that were not right. For this was the path that I had not yet trodden before. Once I had gained the strength of samadhi and been goaded by Thanajanman to go in the way of Panya, I then really exerted myself. Now the kilesas could not remain at rest. I dragged them by the neck and then chopped off their heads. If I could grab their arms and their legs, then I would just grab them and chop them off. If I could take hold of their heads, then I would just take hold of their heads and amputate them. Once one has got to the level of Panya, then the citta will be turning around incessantly. It will have already started revolving from the time when one investigates the body, investigating to see it as asupa. It already starts to turn around then. But the Panya that investigates the body is extremely violent, forceful, vigorous, and dynamic. Once the problem of the body has been solved, and one has fully understood every part of and the nature of the body, then the citta becomes satiated. Once it becomes full like this, then it will no longer investigate the body. Once one is full from eating enough, then what is the use of taking more food or doing that investigation anymore? What then does it become attracted to? Now it will mostly become interested in and drawn towards vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. And the one that is so extremely important is sanya, for sanya is extremely subtle. Sankhara, at least, will flare on and off. But with sanya, it will gradually and simply permeate out to form a picture. It can subtly fantasize and make up concepts. One can't help being amazed by its subtlety. One then keeps track of it, and then it cannot be beyond the ability of Panya. Once Sati and Panya are automatic, or if one prefers, Mahasati and Mahapanya, then what can slip away from it? Once this Sati and Panya is turning around incessantly and naturally by itself all the time, with the exception of the time when one has to restrain it forcefully, then this is called automatic Sati and Panya. Even during the time when one is taking food, this Sati and Panya doesn't take food with one, for it is just going on doing its work. This is how naturally it is turning around, doing the work of investigation. At this stage, all the laziness disappears. One now has to restrain this exertion at some time, or else one can die from exhaustion. One has to hold it back. Sometimes one overtaxes oneself to the extent where one is ready to drop dead. The entire body becomes dead tired. One cannot even walk another step, because during the night time, one didn't have any sleep, and during the daytime, one just cannot go to sleep. The citta just turns around incessantly and ceaselessly, all the time. So I had to restrain it with the parikama of Buddha. I kept repeating Buddha, repeatedly and quickly, not allowing the citta to go out to do the work. I had to make it let go of that work and force it inwards. I had to drag the citta away from doing that work, which is the contention of Panya with the gilesas. However, it was not possible to tell whether one was using the sharp end or the blunt end when it was in close combat. I thought that it was probably using the blunt end, as I was so exhausted and tired. But the heart was still hell-bent in struggling with them. It was only after I had put the citta to rest that I realized what was happening. I forced the citta to take a rest with the means of repeating the parikama butto, repeating it very frequently and continuously, not allowing it to do any concocting at all. I really had to coerce it to get into samadhi, or else it would not want to get in. I had to really master it. But as it had already been used to coercion, it didn't take long for it to be subdued. It began to slowly calm down, and eventually, it became very still. At that point, it seemed like one had now uprooted the thorns. One's strength, energy, and happiness seemed to arise out of nowhere, and it spread throughout the whole body, in addition to diffusing all over the heart. Yet, even when it had rested in this state of calm, one still had to keep control of it. I still was not able to let go of the reins, for as soon as I let go of it, it would immediately withdraw and try to get in to do some more work. I therefore had to keep on containing it. It became restrained, and I could feel this. When I felt that it was the right time, then I let go of it. And it then immediately sprang forth and got right into doing the work and became totally involved with it. Now it seemed like it was using the sharp end, for it didn't take too long to do the investigation in order to cut off the gilesas. Therefore, samadhi is absolutely vital. When it is necessary to take a rest, one cannot afford not to take a rest. When the citta becomes extremely weary and dead tired, it is not right to think that the results of one's work can only come through exertion. Without thinking about resting oneself so that one can become re-strengthened and able to do more work, one should take a rest, go to sleep, and take food, and one should not be concerned with the time lost from doing this, as it is for the purpose of rebuilding one's strength of body, so that one can do further work. It is the same way with both the citta and the element aggregate. In order for them to regain their strength and energy, so that they can further cope with and counter the kilesas, tanha and asava, it is definitely necessary for them to take a rest. When the citta has rested well in samadhi and is rejuvenated, then when panya goes out to do the investigation, it will be like a knife that has been resharpened. The citta is then fully re-strengthened. This is similar to the same knife, the same man, and the same piece of wood that he has been trying to cut. Once the man has rested and the knife has been resharpened, then it doesn't take too much effort to cut the wood into two. It is likewise with sati and panya of this level. Once it has regained its strength and energy and gone out to do the work of investigation, it doesn't take too long for them to cut off the kilesas. One can then see the value of samadhi. This is speaking on the level of the heart that is very subtle. The kilesas are correspondingly subtle, and so are sati and panya. They are all equally subtle. The sati and panya of this level are like water that flows very gently. They are not violent. The investigation of the nama dhamma, vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana, and the investigation of the nature of avijja is handled by the panya of this subtle level. This investigation cannot be done in a rough manner, like the way one investigates the body, and the situation now will indicate as much. One will know this for oneself. It is the same way when one has to hew a piece of wood. When it is coarse, one has to use an axe. But when the surface of the wood is refined, one must use a plane to shave it. One cannot use either a knife or an axe, for one will just ruin the wood. It is likewise with the ways of the citta. Whatever level of panya is suitable will be obvious. One will investigate until one cut off all the kilesas and penetrate to all of the truth. Whenever the investigation is sufficient, then the citta will let go of it. If it hasn't yet let go of the object, then it is not yet sufficient. Once the citta is satiated with the investigation, then it will let go of the object. For instance, when one investigates the body into the nature of asupa, one keeps on investigating until one is satiated with it, and then the citta will let go of the body. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta are all found within the self, same place. In the investigation of sanya, supposition, where does it arise from? It arises from the citta, and then it fools the citta. The sankhara arises out of the citta, and it also deceives the citta. As the sankhara and sanya are both the instruments of avijja, so how can they not deceive the citta? If sati and panya are not capable of catching up with them, then one will still be deluded in them. Therefore, one has to relentlessly analyze and differentiate with sati and panya. Once one has done this many times, then one will become satiated. One first becomes satiated with the investigation of rupa. One then becomes full with the nama dhamma of vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. One then lets go of them. So what then is left that one is not yet satiated with? What remains is just the citta and avijja, that are entangled with one another. But one doesn't yet realize this. This is where one gets to see the subtlety of the kilesas. Once one has entered into the state where it is purely avijja, one can then see clearly that there is nothing more subtle than avijja. It is like lying down in a tiger's cave. When the tiger roars and growls, one takes it that it is just making music for one to listen to. Avijja is comparable to a huge tiger, but one now becomes submissive to it. One loves it and is possessive of it. This is due to the subtlety of the kilesas. The true and genuine master and ruler is avijja, but it still cannot withstand the power of sati and panya. Although the sati and panya of this level will first accept that this citta is subtle, that this citta is luminous, that this citta is brave and bold, that this citta is I and mine, this mahasati and mahapanya will not be complacent. Though it might be taking care of it, it is also vigilant and observant. But since this avijja is samuti, how can the subtle changes of this samuti not come into contact with sati and panya, that is constantly watching, being attentive, and perpetually investigating and analyzing observantly? How can they slip through? Inevitably, it will be able to apprehend any one of the aspects. Once it takes hold of them, then the citta and sati and panya will be turning around right at that point. Then this point becomes the object or target of investigation, like all the other sapava dhammas. So how can it withstand? It will now be broken up. Once it is shattered, one then becomes satiated, and this is the final fulfillment. One was satiated with the investigation of rupa. One has been satiated with the investigation into sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. Furthermore, one becomes satiated with the investigation into one's own body, and the investigation into vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. Once one has thoroughly investigated all round, one then becomes full. But there still remains the citta and avijja. All the bridges have been cut off. There is no way for it to come out. It cannot now get out through vetana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. One now truly understands the nature. This is like cutting the inner bridge. And as far as trying to get out through sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches is concerned, this is even further away. There is no need to talk about this because one has now transcended them, as one has been moving in closer and closer. What remains is just avijja. Now it doesn't have any hiding place, so it stands out very distinctively. This is because everything has now been uncloaked. Rupa has already been unveiled, for it used to cover this thing up. Vetana of sukha and dukkha and neutral has also already been removed. All the coarse and subtle vetanas have been eliminated, but the most subtle of the vetanas is still found within avijja. Once one has unveiled avijja, then this most subtle vetana will be removed. As long as avijja remains, this most subtle vetana will also still remain. So one keeps on uncloaking these things. One uncovers sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. One keeps clearing them all away. And in the final moment, one will uncloak avijja. Once one has uncovered avijja, then vetana will all disappear. For this reason, whether it is correct or not, and speaking on my own authority, because it is so clear within my heart, I dare to speak about all the arahants who have already got rid of all the kilesas. I am not speaking about myself, who is like a small tiny mouse. How can the arahant have vetana within his citta? Whatever kind of vetana it might be, it is not found within the citta of an arahant. Once one has become satiated with the investigation, one then no longer does it anymore. Once one becomes full, then the citta is no longer deceived by itself. It is not deluded in anything, and it also isn't deluded with the state of purity. Once one becomes satiated, then one comes to a standstill. This is what is meant by contentment. One no longer grabs at this or that. There is no hunger or craving. This contentment progresses in stages, and one lets go in stages. Whatever are the objects or conditions that one becomes satiated with, one will let go of them. Then one keeps on moving further inwards, until finally one becomes full with the citta and avijja. One then lets go of them. One can now do so completely. Then all the problems come to an end, and there is nothing further to talk about. This is the shedding of all forms of dukkha. They are all cast away at the time of the cessation of avijja, which is brought about by the power of mahasati, mahapanya, satta, and one's diligent effort. They are like thunderbolts of the most advanced and modern type. This is the end. From there onwards, it doesn't really matter where one lives. Once the samuti within the heart has come to an end, then whether one stays or one goes away, it is just merely a way of talking. The day and night no longer play any significant role, and it is likewise with the days, the months, and the years. Or Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Or the year of the rat, or of the oxen, and so forth. They are all merely suppositioned. It is all right to play with these suppositions, if one is not deluded in them. But to play with them, and also be deluded in them, is not good. And this is the self-same citta that had to wage an uphill struggle, and had to nearly lose its life, and was nearly lost to wickedness and corruption, due to the kilesas, tanha and asava, damaging it and destroying it. But all this is due to one's dogged determination for one who is a practitioner. This achievement cannot be beyond one's ability. All that is needed is that one must be true and earnest. There is no problem with the Dhamma of the Lord Buddha, the Majjhima. It is beyond doubt in its ability to overcome any kind of kilesa. Every type of Majjhima is capable of overcoming every type of kilesa. There isn't a single kilesa that is sharper, keener, wiser, or more clever than sati and panya, which is the maga. That is why it is called Majjhima, which means suitability. It is suitable for the overcoming and correcting of every kind of kilesa. This is the interpretation that I most prefer. There is a time when one can shed off the dukkha that arises from one's striving and exertion. There is an end to it. Once one has vanquished it, then it will be eliminated forever, with nothing remaining. There is a time when we can lay aside the burden that we have been shouldering so arduously. There is an end to it. We can then live in bliss. Is there ever an end to the worldly undertaking? Is there such a work that there can be an end to it? This work will never come to an end, even at the end of one's life. One passes away and is parted from one's work, one's friends, one's relatives, one's father and mother, one's husband or wife, and one's own body. One dies leaving one's work incomplete. But there is an end to this other undertaking. This is the work of mastering the kilesas. There is an end to it. When the kilesas have been totally vanquished, then this work comes to an end. The Lord called this Vusitang Brahmacharyam. This can be simply translated as the end of one's work. The holy and the chaste life is the work of overcoming the kilesas. The work of countering the kilesas has now come to an end, because all of the kilesas have been totally eliminated. For those who have fully achieved their purpose, the practice for the purpose of the Vihara Dhamma, which is the maintenance for a peaceful coexistence between the khandhas and the citta, is left to each individual disposition and inclination and preference. For this practice has nothing to do with the kilesas. They do this without having any real purpose behind it. As long as the life process of the body still goes on, then there is still the necessity of maintaining it, feeding it, and giving it the proper exercise. This is something quite normal, and we all have to take care of it, like this. Everyone will know for himself how much he has to put in, how much he has to eat or drink, how much he has to walk, stand, or take a rest, and go to sleep. Everyone knows this. He knows the necessity of what he has to do in order to maintain the khandhas. It is also the same way with those who have already passed beyond. They know how to take care and deal with the khandhas and the citta that still coexist with one another. But the massive burden that has always been oppressing the citta for so long, and which is so much more heavy than any other thing, has already been laid down by them and been cast away, leaving nothing behind. We must also strive in achieving this, for we are fighters and not evaders. We have to really contend with them, being very earnest and serious. We really have to set our heart into the work of practice. You should not be doubtful or uncertain of the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana. What is the reason for uncertainty about it? Every aspect of the Dhamma taught by the Lord Buddha is for the Magga, Pala, and Nibbana. His teaching doesn't aim at futility. Why are you doubtful of it? This doubt is the work of the kilesas deceiving us. We have to be firm and certain. Our satta must be the conviction of the Magga and Pala, and the conviction in our ability. Virya is the striving and strenuous exertion of ourselves. Chanda is satisfaction. Citta is the making of the citta to be inclined to and concentrated in the work of exertion. Vimamsa is to investigate, contemplate, and analyze. One must not practice in a stupid way, lacking in sati and panya, as one will then never come across any benefit or result. It can only amuse regulators. End of Desana.